You are listening to a talk given at the Brisbane City Bible Forum. We hope you enjoy the presentation.
This Luke Ferry wrote a book 7 or 8 years ago called A Brief History of Thought, and he talks about now that we've moved away a bit from family as defining our lives, and community, the village where we live, is defining our lives. All sorts of things no longer define our lives. He says this: work becomes the defining activity of man, or men or women. I think he's using, he's French, right? You must excuse him for, that. Work becomes the defining activity of man. A human being who does not work is not merely poor without income, but impoverished in that he cannot realize his potential and his purpose on earth. You don't work, you don't have any meaning. He cannot realize his potential and purpose on earth. He goes on a little bit, I skip a little bit, and then he goes on a bit further. In the modern world, work becomes an arena for self-realization. A means not merely of educating oneself, but also of fulfillment and improvement. That's why you should work hard. Self-realization. Personhood. To be the true, real, deep, wonderful you were made to be.
Sounds like my boss wrote that.
And yet, 2004 Gallup report of worker satisfaction in America found that as many as 70% of Americans don't feel engaged by their current job. Or take Benjamin Honeycutt, he's a historian at University of Iowa, and he wrote this, citing from an article called World Without Work from the Atlantic magazine, said this: purpose, meaning, identity, fulfillment, creativity, autonomy, all these that positive psychology has shown us to be necessary for well-being are absent in the average job. So I think on one hand Luke Ferry is right, isn't he, that we feel like work is part of meaning and purpose and identity and what we were kind of made for when you hit that right. And yet, Benjamin Honeycutt points out that, if scanning products at Coles was a video game, you would hardly call that, meaningful, purposeful engagement. You'd say that's mind-numbingly boring. See, here's the tension. Which is it? Is work about your personhood, your identity, your meaning? Or is work just something to put bread on the table and a roof over your house, and it's just this kind of awful thing that you have to do, and meaning and purpose is found somewhere else? And at the same time, I imagine as you're listening to those quotes, you feel both, don't you? I suspect you feel both, and it varies depending on which day it is and which side of bed you got out and how strong the coffee was. You feel both at work, like which part of the project you're at. There's some people love the startup, it's exciting, and then other people hate the startup, but when it's, Here's the tension, right? What is work? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to go with bad news first, to see that what people are realizing about work is something that people have realized for a long time. Bad news first, good news about work second, and then thirdly, a different way to think about work. Bad news first. And this is actually to say, this feeling or experience that you have about work, that it is just unengaging and not purposeful, actually the Bible recognizes that. This ancient writer 3,000 years ago says, really, you needed to do research to realize that? Give me a break. Firstly, he says, you won't be remembered for your work. Why is work meaningless? Bad news, you won't be remembered for your work. So in that little section there, he says, in kind of 13 to 14, look, wisdom, he's Solomon, he's the great wise man. Wisdom is better than folly, but both the wise man and the fool are marching to the grave. The only advantage of the wise man is that he stubs his toe less often on his way to his casket. That's what he says, right? If you're wise, the march to the grave is much less painful. He's having a bad day, not enough coffee. Verse 15. Let me just show that to you in the text. Then I said to myself, it's in the third paragraph there at the top, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What do I gain then being by wise? He said, this too is vanity. It's like a puff of air. It just passes away. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. And see what he says then, start of the next paragraph, verse 17. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. See, there's this connection. In the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, first part of this chapter, he was the great worker who achieved these great works. And we see how much he achieved. And if you know anything of Solomon, he achieved amazing things. And then he steps back and goes, all my wisdom enabled me to achieve this great work, but I'm going to die. And then it won't be remembered after me. See, his life is full of work. That's why he hates his life. Because the work doesn't achieve anything. It doesn't even achieve a memory of him. My translation says, the wise man like the fool will not be long remembered. You might be remembered for a generation. Your children or your children's children might remember you. And then that's it. Let me prove it to you. Who designed the Sydney Harbour Bridge?
Bill Sydney.
See? Known all around the world. Amazing, iconic piece of architecture that if you live in Sydney, you've driven over it, you've wondered it, you've glorified it. It's amazing, right?
Was it a Scandinavian? No,
that was the who designed the Story Bridge?
The same guy.
Well done. John Bradfield, same guy. All right. Well, we've got one person who remembers him. Who was the Premier of Queensland at the time?
I'm not that old.
Joe Jokovic. Yeah. William Forbes Smith. You will not long be remembered. Who designed the first computer? Something you use every day.
Charles Babbage.
Ooh, well done. The first mechanical computer was Charles Babbage. See, but what do we know about them? Do we know anything about them? What mattered to them? What drove them? The best we've got is one person in this room of really bright people is a name. You will not be long remembered. Do you really want to wrap up all of your life's purpose and meaning in your work? You won't be remembered for what you achieved. I'm really sorry to say that, but it's really true. And I'm a Christian minister, and you know what? In a generation or two, I'm leaving the City Bible Forum. I'm out of here. You know, in 3 or 4 years, it'll be like, Glenn who? Who was that guy who started it? We don't know anymore. A few people will go, what was his name? Hamburg? Honberg? Oh, I can't remember. A small plaque. Yeah. In the residential college that I went to as a university student, it used to be an all-men's college, and then it became mixed, and one student protested severely over it. So they put a plaque for him. It's the Matt Giblin Memorial Urinal. So they put a plaque for him over the one, because he made some comment, there'll be only one place where women are not allowed. And so they put a plaque there in memory of that comment. I don't think the college administration did it, I think some of the students did it. It's still there. You will not have a legacy, but also the thing that you've achieved at your work won't last. That's the second point of bad news. Verse 18 here, I hated all the things that I had. So he hated life because of the work, and then I hated all the things that I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, and yet he'll have control over it. Verse 20, so my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor. See, you might be tempted to think, yeah, but at least some of the things I've done, that they'll live on. Those things will live on. My bridge will live on. I'm sorry if you've heard me talk about this before, but it's just such a good illustration. This is the symbol of the Barings Bank. The Barings Bank, amazing, famous, right? Barings Bank helped the United States buy Louisiana, which was actually a much bigger province than just the state, from Napoleon, to create the United States, and as we know it. That's how important the Barings Bank was, right? They worked close with the British monarchy. They established ties with King George V. the descendants of this bank became had peerages in England and became barons in England. The bank survived World War I and World War II. They were essential to the war effort. They actually were the bank that was pivotal to England liberating funds for the war effort. It existed from 1762 until 1995. 230 years. Amazing. Amazing. And it was brought down in a single year by one man.
Nick Leeson.
Nick Leeson, a derivatives trader in Singapore. In a few months of trading, online trading, Nick Leeson ended 230 something years of financial history and influence. And if you want a small part of Barings Bank now, open a savings account with ING, because they swallowed the remnant whole in 1995. Nick Leeson met Woody Allen's definition of a stockbroker, which is, a broker is someone who invests other people's money until it's all gone. Verse 20. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a man or a woman may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. Nick Leeson. What's going on here? Well, behind it is this theme of death, isn't it? It's kind of recurrent. See, none of our work achieves what we ultimately want, which is life. That's his third point. Verse 22. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving which he labours under the sun? All his days, his work, his pain and grief, even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is a vanity. What it means is, it's a passing breath. It's here one moment, gone the next. All that labour and stress and anxiety and sleepless nights, of the whole of your life in a moment is just gone. You are a fast fading flower. A bromeliad, if you know them. A bromeliad flower lasts a day or two. Beautiful, incandescent, amazing. How could this flower come out of that mosquito pit? And 2 days later, it's gone. You work and work and work, and then you die. See, he's saying death is the future. Genesis chapter 3, God says this to Adam. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. So you will work hard. You will get bread. You will feed your family and yourself. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread until you return to the ground. For out of it you are taken, for you are dust, and dust you will return. We think that somehow, if we can work hard enough, there's this sense that we can get a hold of life and keep life. That actually we can keep death and sickness at bay. But the most we can do is eat some bread till you return to the ground. Heard of Tolstoy, right? He wrote War and Peace, old Russian writer. If Tolstoy wore a t-shirt, and he wouldn't have, they didn't have t-shirts back then, I think. His Russian smock, if they printed on Russian smocks, this is what he would have worn around. Is there any meaning in my life that wouldn't be destroyed by the death that inevitably awaits me? Work will not give us life. That's bad news. But it's kind of good news, isn't it? Doesn't that kind of liberate what you think's happening at work? Doesn't that kind of take the pressure off? That work is not life. That work does not equal life. That all your meaning and identity and purpose is not found just in your work. That if work goes badly, that doesn't mean life is going badly. Actually, this sounds like really bad news, but actually I think it's surprisingly liberating. Just takes that pressure off. This project is good, I should work hard, but it's not going to be my great legacy, because there are no legacies that last. This project matters and I should work hard, but I shouldn't so work so hard as if I'm killing myself, because cannot keep death at bay. That's the bad news. We cannot achieve life. I think this is what fuels us on. We somehow think that we can achieve life, life forever, if we just work hard enough. We can't. That's the bad news. But the Bible has a profoundly positive view of work. We don't have time to dig into it too much. The first occurrences of the word work in the Bible are where? Anyone know? Genesis chapter 2, and three times it gets used that God works. The Bible has a profoundly positive view of work. God himself works. What difference does that make? Well, I've been reading this book. It's fascinating and fantastic. The Book That Made Your World by Vishal Mangalwadi. I hope I've pronounced his name right. Fantastic book. A man who wanted to see India transformed. And so that's interesting because he comes with an Eastern understanding of Buddhism and Hinduism and Eastern worldviews, and is trying to understand why is it that the West is the way it is, and looked at lots of the Western university ideas and realized that they weren't deep enough or rich enough, and came to the Bible eventually. But he said that's a fascinating idea that God works. Fascinating, because if you're a Hindu mystic, what did you do? Well, you withdrew. Creation is an illusion. The highest form of life is contemplation. Same with Greek thinking as well. So you withdraw. But the Christian perspective is God works. Engagement with the world is actually meaningful and positive. If God works, then those made in his image. Work is actually an amazingly positive thing. That's the first point. God works. Secondly, work is a profoundly good thing as part of God's original creation for people. God placed Adam and Eve in the garden and says, you shall work for it and take care of it. The word work there used in Genesis 2:15 is the same word used of priests in the temple. Think about that for a moment. Adam's role in growing the garden was the same as the priest's role when they served God in the temple in the Old Testament. What is that? How does that elevate work? It's saying it's actually like it's sacred. It's like it's spiritual. It has this vertical dimension of being able to honor God, and also it had a vertical dimension of the earth. The word take care of it is actually the word keep, protect, guard. Humanity's role was actually to look after the world. It's profoundly good. Let me talk about how good work is and why, I guess with a negative example, a place called Youngstown in America, it had a sheet and tube, Campbell Works, kind of steelmaking works in 1977. It shut down. This town was built around that steelworks industry. The city that lost 50,000 jobs and $1.3 billion in manufacturing wages. Lots of work stopped. Okay, it's just work, right? Actually, the effect was so severe that a new term was coined to describe the fallout called regional depression. And Youngstown, and there's a big study on it, was transformed not only by economic disreputation, but by psychological and cultural breakdown. Depression, spousal abuse, and suicide all became more prevalent. The caseload of the mental area health center tripled within a decade, and the city built four prisons in the 1990s, the only growth industry. See, work is a profoundly important part of the world, and it is good, and Luke Ferry is kind of right. So, God created, first point, God created work, God worked, and it's good. God made work a good part of humanity's place in the world. It is therefore intrinsically good. Not just for the things that you achieve because of it, but the work itself, actually the doing of the job is good. Haven't you ever experienced this? You've got a job you put off and put off and put off, like cleaning the bathroom. And then you finally get stuck into it and clean the bathroom. And in the middle of it, you find yourself whistling while you're at work. Even though it's a bathroom, it's a bit stinky and it's a bit horrible, in the middle of the work, it's actually pretty enjoyable. I can see some of you nodding. Some of you are acknowledging that. Most of you are like, no, not really the bathroom. Okay, look, I grew up on a farm. I've got worse jobs than that. Just come and talk to me. The other thing the Bible says is work has never been an individualistic enterprise. And that's one of our problems. See, work was originally conceived with that vertical dimension of serving God and a horizontal dimension. Adam, when he worked in the garden, was serving on the earth. Why? For all those people who would come after him that he would fill it with Eve. And it wasn't just his family. He was kind of working to serve God and the world. It was never an individualistic enterprise. Work has always been conceived of serving others. In the New Testament, that gets picked up, where Paul says, the thief must steal no longer, but must work with his hands. And his letter to the Ephesians. Why? In order that he might have something to give. Fascinating. Work is always conceived as being for the other. Vishal Mangalwadi picks that up on. He talks about two things in the book. He contrasts and compares Benedictine monks with people who worked in Hindu monasteries. And he says, very interesting, or people from the Hindu culture in India. He says, fascinating. Monks saw they worked in their monasteries because work was from God and work was good. So they didn't just step away from work. They worked. But then why did they develop technology? Because they saw that toil and the degrading of what it meant to be human was not good. So there were things, there were water mills and spinning mills, but only in the West, under monasteries, did they convert that technology into grinding grain using water mills and using donkeys and horses to pull grinding wheels. Why didn't that happen, he says, in India, even though the technology was in India and China beforehand? Well, actually, because you could just get other people to do the work. You could just find slaves to do it. And it was, so as long as you had enough slaves or enough children or enough women, there was no need to develop technology. And so this idea that work itself was good, but people shouldn't be degraded through it, came through in Christianity. That's one example. Another one he gives through is the combine harvester. The McCormick harvester changed the world. Kind of went on display in the World Fair in 1851. It kind of changed the world. It was known as kind of bringing their motto was, our field is the world. A bit of global domination going on there, maybe not great. But it's fascinating, see that quote there? In industrialized countries, because of the reaper and the harvester, 2-5% of the population now cultivates more land than was ploughed when most people spent their lives growing food. So this idea of working for the other, he's saying, and caring for people led to the rise of technology. Because the guy who invented this saw slaves working in the field on his plantation and thought, this is not right, this has to change. And developed a harvester so that slaves wouldn't have to do this work. The Bible profoundly argues that work is good. God does it. It's made good for us. It's never been an individualistic enterprise, and it's actually made so we can serve people, which I think fundamentally changes our orientation. Where does the meaning in work come from? If it's all about us finding our achievement, us finding our fulfillment, work will always be unfulfilling. If God has made work so that we can serve others, that's when we'll find meaning in our work. When we start to locate, how is it that my work is to serve others? How is it contributing? Because if it's always about me trying to find my fulfillment, it just won't achieve that. See, why is work so frustrating? We want it to achieve more than it can. We're on to the third point, downhill run. See, we need a different way to think about work. Why is work frustrating and difficult? We want it to achieve more than it can. Imagine if you planted a lemon tree in your backyard. You pruned it, looked after it, you fed it, took poo. That's what's good for citrus fruit, right? But every time you went to that lemon tree and you expected oranges, how'd you feel? Pretty frustrated. pretty annoyed because you're going to this tree, it's a lemon tree, and it won't give you any oranges. That's what we do with work. We look for the wrong meaning at work. We look for oranges, and it's giving us lemons, which are perfectly good for lemonade. They're good for lemon tart, great for lemon sorbet. We're looking at the wrong thing. See, human beings are made to work, and work is good, but work was never meant to be a source of ultimate meaning. Luke Ferry says, in the modern age, work is about finding your purpose and your potential and about self-realization. The Bible says, bah humbug. And if you look to work for that, it will crush you. Because it can't achieve that for you. God never made it to do that. And if it doesn't crush you, it'll crush the people around you as you were trying to get those things out of your work and get to the top and crush the people around you. See, we look for the wrong meaning. Now, Martin Luther had this great insight in the Reformation. He was saying, all work is good. Even the most mundane work is good. As a mother cares for her children, it is a great work of serving God. And so suddenly all work, because you get to serve God, is elevated. Even the most boring, mundane work, when you see not just that you get to serve people, but serve a creator, changes how you view that work. It's no longer about your meaning and your purpose. And so that's changed the Western world. And Vishal Mangalwadi says more and more about that. So why has God made work so difficult if it's supposed to be good? It's actually so that we might look to his work. Let me take you to the final quote. We might look to his work. Yeah, it's Hugh Jackman. Apparently he's starring in a movie to be the Apostle Paul. Who knows if that's going to come off. But I just like that picture of Hugh Jackman. It makes Wolverine look slightly different, doesn't it? It's from Ephesians chapter 2. Have a listen to this. A familiar passage, but think about it in the context of work. God made work difficult so that we might look to his work of meaning and purpose in our lives. For it is by grace you've been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. See, I think we often, if we've got a Christian background, a religious background, we might fill that with religious works. I actually think it's bigger. It's bigger. He's saying, you're not rescued, you're not saved, you don't have purpose and meaning through what you do. It's not from yourselves, it's not found within you, and it's not from what you achieve. It comes another way. It comes through God's amazing generosity. He's talking about knowing him, salvation, and you get it through trusting. And have a look where he takes this. He comes back to the whole idea of creation. He says, for we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. He's saying, actually, when you come to know your creator who created work through Jesus, you now actually are recreated, as it were, in him. To do what? To do the good works. Again, he doesn't mean religious. He means to have all of your life, Sunday through to Sunday, including Monday, Tuesday, Friday, Wednesday, all of your life lived out under this person of Jesus, shaped by him, honoring him, and honoring other people in light of that. And the amazing thing is, you get to do the good works which is God prepared in advance for us to do. How involved is God in your workplace? How much does it matter to him? Saying he's actually involved, he's prepared those works that you might do even in your workplace to serve other people and to serve him. The bad news. Work won't get you a legacy. Work won't thwart death. Work won't give you life. But work is good and filled with meaning and purpose. But ultimate meaning comes from knowing the ultimate reality, God. And so God is a severe mercy in your workplace, constantly making work difficult, so you won't look for purpose and meaning in your work, but you might look to Him and know His generosity and mercy so that you can do good work.